Hey, this is Tim Hunzi, partner of Parallel Music Publishing and board member of the Nashville Association of Independent Music Publishers. Thanks for listening to the Nashville Pubcast. This episode of Nashville Pubcast, we have Jesse Frazier of Rhythm House. We grind out his path from tape guy to producer, publisher, and hit songwriter. I think people are going to be really interested in hearing your story and how you see it as it progressed for yourself.
Sure. From Detroit, and kind of went to high school in Flint and ended up going to Michigan State for the first couple years of college. I was one of the fortunate ones that kind of knew pretty early on you want to be in the music business. I was in a musical household. My dad played bass in the Detroit music scene. My uncle played drums for Trisha Yearwood a little bit at the time, and so he was kind of in between gigs and doing things, but we would always just take road trips down here. Worked at this little publishing company. They closed within 6 months of me being there. Tom Schuyler was running it and Cindy Foreman, and it just was a classic music industry story. So it was like, oh, this is how it goes. Quickly met a guy named Scott Sherrod, and he kind of brought me into the wings at Major Bob Music. A girl named Becca Calloway at the time, Becca Tischker now was there. And they were amazing. They kind of both took me under their wings and schooled me in independent music publishing. I started off in tape copy. We were still in DAT tapes at the time.
I remember transferring all that stuff, man. We even had reel-to-reel. I started to transfer some of that.
We had it around. Fortunately, I was kind of past that a little bit, but it was there. So there was definitely some moments where I had to put reel to DAT. You know?
Oh, wow.
And I moved to town to be a songwriter. But I was pretty intimidated by it. I remember taking a Tom Shapiro class at Belmont and just going, man, these guys, Neil Thrasher was at Major Bob, and I was just intimidated. It just was like, I can't do it. This isn't not me. It wasn't that I didn't like it. I never really listened to country music at the time, but I really appreciated the craft of it. And I just fell in love with publishing and thought, I'm cool with not being a writer. I would just DJ and maybe I'll make some remixes on the side, but my career is going to be on the business side. Somewhere along the lines in that path, a couple different things happened. You mentioned Carol Ann Mobley.
Right.
She asked me to DJ a birthday party for her. I think it was in East Nashville.
It was.
And from that experience, she got a phone call from a friend asking for a local DJ. She recommended me. Well, it turns out it was the governor's daughter's engagement party. And at that event, there was a event planner there named Colin Cowie. And I didn't know who he was at the time. I came back and said, I met this guy. He said he loved my stuff and wanted me to do other parties. This was his party. He was planning for the governor. And my wife goes, I know him. He does stuff for Oprah and like the Kardashians. So cut to the next few years of my life. I'm flying all over the world doing weird events from Alyssa Milano's wedding to, you know, parties for Cash Money Records, Drake and Nicki and Lil Wayne and Kim Zolciak on Real Housewives of Atlanta's wedding and just random stuff. We'd be in Mexico for New Year's and Atlantis.
I remember being in awe of you at this point in time thinking, man, how is he getting all these cool gigs? This is the coolest stuff ever.
It was crazy. It was, I always just was like, why are you flying this white kid from Nashville to Hollywood to DJ Cash Money Records parties? But I think, like anything in life, if we know something can go smooth in one aspect of it, we're going to at least do that, because everything else could be a variable, right?
Right.
So if you know something works, repeat that.
Tipping my hat to you as I'm one of the early guys in that field of writer, producer, and business guy. You have kind of the whole triple threat there that not everybody has had. And that's what I think is unique to a number of new executives coming up in the music business, that it's changing the game a lot.
Yeah. It's interesting because there was a little pushback. You start getting some cuts, and there was a lot of people in town that were sort of like, look, dude, you got to focus. You can't do one or the other. And my thing was, and I always had told the people that I worked for, is look, if it becomes an issue, I'm going to know it before you do. I know when writers start to feel like, wait, am I competing with my VP, or is he after his own good, or, you know, but I was showing them that, you know, I'm bringing Carrie out, and, you know, his first number one was my first number one, and I'm doing demos for them. I was doing tracks for them. I was pulling him in opportunities. I think you have to be careful in anything in life. You know, anytime you split focus, you're splitting focus. I don't care what line of work you're in. But the way my brain works, I don't recommend every writer being a publisher. And I don't recommend every publisher being a writer. I think I truly enjoy, I get more fired up about my writers getting a cut than I getting a cut on that record. And if you can't say that, if you can't truly, and it's one thing to say it out loud, but if you can't truly be as content with that, then you probably shouldn't be a publisher.
Okay, Rhythm House, man. Like, what brought that on? You were working at Major Bob, and you started getting your activity and getting some cuts and everything. So what instigated or what brought that on? Probably, I'm going to guess, there's some luck involved or something.
Sure. I mean, I'm the poster child of just do things your own way. Don't chase and don't conform too much. Don't be stubborn, you know. But after 15 years at Major Bob, my writing career was sort of blossoming and good things were happening. My corporate career or my business side sort of had hit a ceiling. For about a year and a half that there was opportunities out there, I just was being super picky because when you grow up with so much freedom and the ability to jump genres at any moment and not have to do expense reports or whatever else it is, you're just used to someone kind of trusting that you're out there hustling it for the betterment of the company. So I was really careful about jumping into a corporate partnership or a corporate job or just any role that was going to be like, hey, we want you to produce XYZ. And, you know, but at the same time, there was guys like Scott Borchetto was kind of coming after me for different positions and ideas. And I had a ton of respect for him and still do. And so that kind of built confidence in me, just going, man, that, you know, he was persistent in calling, go, we could figure things out and do whatever you want to do. And nothing that just sort of, I knew there was going to be that moment. I never wanted to stay someplace out of fear, but I just knew that eventually it had to be the right fit. Well, Ben Vaughn had tried to kind of bring me over to Chapel and knew my kind of stance on, no, I'm not interested in doing that. But then he called again and said, hey, I have been talking to Roc Nation and they kind of want to open a flag here. And I said, you have to meet Jesse. So I was in L.A. for the Grammys, and Tamara, who runs the publishing company in L.A., invited me to a writer retreat they were having. So we went to this Mansion in the Hills thing and sat down with them. And that went really good. I liked her. As I was leaving, my phone rang, and it was Jay Brown saying, come to my office right now. Basically, it was sort of like, tomorrow, see if this kid's worth the shit.
A little bit of a setup. Right.
So I went right to his office. And I, you know, I hadn't experienced too much stuff in the, you know, the urban side of the industry other than the cash money parties, which were always crazy. So I didn't know what to expect. And, you know, I was a little naive to the full stretch of Roc Nation. You know, now I know it's like sports agency and, you know, all genres and Latin music, and they have Nigerian music and all kinds of stuff going on, and artist management. But just sitting there, it was amazing. Jay just said, look, you know, you don't need us. We could really use you, though.
And nice opening line.
Yeah.
By the way. Dude, you were in right there.
Yeah. He was also, he just looked at me in the, you know, in the eye the whole time, no cell phone. You know, for an hour and a half, we sat in his office, and there's a guy who's managing Rihanna, and she's about to drop a record at the time. And, you know, so he just sort of gave me undivided attention. I loved his philosophy. He was just like, look, we're not going to be shoving music down your throat. We're not going to say, hey, this is country, sign this. We just want to have a brand ambassador and a partner. So I signed with Roc Nation and Warner Chappell. And then Rhythm House was a partnership between myself and Roc Nation that we opened up about a year and a half ago. BJ Hill splits time between us and Warner Chappell. So he came on board on the creative team. My wife grew up in publishing, Stevie, and she joined our team. And then I ended up signing Carrie Barlow, and we just signed Stephen Lee Olson and a young, amazing writer-producer named Brandon Day. And
it's great. All great. Yeah. Nice, so nice staff of writers already. Yeah. So
it's been fun, man. I'm very slow to sign writers. I feel like
I was going to ask the philosophy. That was going to be one of my questions. Like, what? How do you? What's your process in that? I'm a dater. That's the word I use. I'm very much a dater.
Absolutely, dude. It's personality, personality, personality. I will pass on a prolific writer if I can't hang with them. You know, we've been doing this long enough to know. There's those ones that roll into the parking lot, and you're like, oh man, my next 2 hours are shot. You know, I want everyone that comes into that building. My family's there, man. This is my dream scenario. I've got, you know, 80s arcades in the front.
Yeah.
My studio in the back.
Possibly the coolest office in town. Again, something to be envious of or jealous. I think jealous is the right word. Envious is bad. But
the last thing you want to do is get into a, you know, these are not employees. These are partners, right? I don't care what their co-pub scenario is. These are partnerships.
Absolutely.
And the ones that understand that, and understand that, look, you know, I'm going to partner with you. This is a team. I'm going to listen to you. Even though I'm not their boss, they're signing on to be a partner and help us guide their brand, right? And you can tell pretty quickly, man, if you start, like you said, dating is a great term for it. You start bringing someone in to some situations, you give them a couple tasks, maybe you give them a remix, or you, if it's a producer, maybe, you know, Brandon's cutting his teeth. I gave him a Marry Me remix to see what he would do with it, you know, or put them into a couple situations, ask the writers how they handle themselves, what do they bring to the room, go have dinner with them, how do they treat their wife, their girlfriend, whatever. That's the kind of stuff, man. It's like those things will rear their head pretty quickly within a couple months, you know, and I've just never been the guy that goes, oh, well, I've got another offer from so-and-so. And I said, man, if that's where your heart's leading, you got to go do that. I'm not going to do something quicker and get off of our pace of exploring this relationship just because someone else wants you.
Do you see any changes on the A&R and record label side? I'm kind of envisioning, I see us as publishers specifically, and I know you guys on what you do because you're hiring a lot of and have in-house the producer angle, and we know that we're doing a lot more artist development. Do you see any changes that you might see where there will be more and more co-ventures, maybe some partnering up with labels on production sides and creating more joint venture companies coming in the future? This is something I'm kind of feeling I see happening because they just don't have the time and the resources to do it anymore.
Sure. Not to mention the revenue stream of Spotify and the master ownership is
a fancy new word, master ownership, buddy.
It's strikingly different, you know, and there's a lot of money happening in that field. So the bottom line is I do think we have been in an A&R facility. There's some amazing A&R people in this town still to this day.
Yeah.
But you know, the publishing ranks are taking chances on developing, a lot of times, funds. You know, I can't tell how many times have you invested in artists to go cut some sides with somebody or this or the other. Or even if it's a in-house produced thing, you send it to go get mixed.
So, or you give your time to write with them. There's
a lot of
artist development. Is when one of my friends sends me an artist, we're helping that artist as well. It's just the time and money.
One thing that Nashville runs into, and I definitely saw this first when, you know, I remember explaining to an attorney, yeah, I'm a writer producer, but we're writers on the song too. And they'd be like, well, why, how come, you know, Paul Worley wasn't a co-writer on this stuff with the Dixie Chicks? And I'm like, well, it's different. We're like,
it's a different situation. In the room actually writing the song.
So, you know, but I see it in our contracts sometimes. We're very, you know, slow to change things. And, you know, some, like, just for instance, one topic that I talk with young producers on is, your typical Nashville publishing deal, has the publishing company owning 100% of this demo, whatever you want to call this thing, right? This demo master term only exists in
this town.
I had
an episode addressing this issue, actually, because it's getting more complicated.
Yeah, it is getting complicated because it came from the cost of going into a studio and the publishers, you know, putting this money on the table for you to go make this demonstration recording and come back and, you know, on the cheap side, we'd go to the Ruckus Room and spend, what, $2,500, $3,000 for five sides or something like that, right, and split it out. But at the end of the year, you were lucky if all of your co-writers paid you what they owed you. They might even be signed, but we would carry like $50,000 to $70,000 debts into the next year of demo recordings. So it's interesting that some of these writers are using rigs in studios that their publishers provided. Some of them are not. Some of them are just bringing their own thing to the situation. And, you know, if you were to add up the cost savings that have happened in the last 5 to 7 years of producer writers helping out on demos compared to, I mean, I just know personally, we used to budget $10,000 per writer per year.
Still.
You know, and you're still there. But imagine what it was then compared to now. Most of your writers probably, you know, at least 50% of their calendar is probably with a writer producer at some stage in their career, right? Probably more. I know
we're creeping towards six-figure savings at this point. Yeah. I can say as my company and what my bottom line looks like, it's a and just in 7 years,
right,
drastically different now, right, on what my debt is on just demos.
So we need to restructure our publishing deals in certain ways. I do think the publisher, even if they're not paying for the studio or the cost of this demo, they're adding value to this quote-unquote demo or master. There should be some ownership there. There should be some ownership with these writers if they don't have any costs coming from the publisher. We should be looking at, if we're developing talent, maybe there are some JVs we do with Spotify ownership. We should look at production money in this town, like production advances. I can go produce a baby side in pop music and see 15 to 20K a side, whereas in town, the top ends are 4 or 5K a side. Now, the cost that they're doesn't mean that the label's not spending a lot of money. It's just going into different spots. But we need to look at points differently. We're basically looking at the same points we have for the last 5 to 7 years for production. So all these things, we just need to stop. Well, this is the way it's done. Well, it needs to stop because the time is different.
I hate the phrase, we've never done it this way before. Well, great. Let's perfect. Not. Right, that's now, that's not currently working, so let's try a different angle.
And I think it's a little bit, I think that the labels are getting more open-minded. You see managers getting more open-minded. I was approached last year about working with a young development guy, and it was not just a production agreement. It was a production agreement that included a piece of career, you know, and it was just you're invested in developing this. So I think everyone's got to start looking at everything different. And every time you do a deal, you know, assuming you don't sign a writer every 6 months, maybe you do. But every 6 months, maybe you need to brush that up and go, man, this deal is a little archaic in the way we're doing the min-max, for instance. Right. That's a great example of, not to get too technical, but there's all kinds of aspects of our deals that
it gets hard moving the attorneys quicker than I think we on the creative, not beating them up, but that's just, they're so systematic in their processes. I had this conversation with an attorney about just independent producer deals. Cause you know, I have artists, I develop artists, and then I got to get to track.
Sure.
So then there's begets a conversation with the writer producer, whether it's ABU, and then you're at a different level, but a new guy, and you're like, okay, what's it going to cost? And then there might be a player on it, and then you might have to gauge attorneys. And even if that writer, let's say, we'll just keep this on a hypothetical number. Say the guy's like, I'll give you the track for $1,500, and I'm like, all right, I'll buy that. But then I got to do a producer agreement, which is fair, I'm down with. Sure. But then that means we're engaging attorneys, each of us, and all of a sudden he might even see maybe 500 or half of that money in his pocket, and I'm out producer fees or attorney's fees, and we got to simplify some of this stuff on the front end, on the indie level, up to the master level. But yeah, I agree. It's we're right there though. I feel the change is coming. It's just people don't know what to do yet, but the conversations are starting. It feels like
you see the artists getting frustrated too. Like I think they all want to operate like Drake does. In other words, we wrote this today and tonight it's on Spotify.
Yeah,
we're all afraid of screwing up the album cycle or screwing up a single's life, and that has to do a little bit with the way our genre consumes music. Terrestrial radio is still king. Spotify in country is one of the smallest genres of Spotify. It's growing, and we're seeing artists get attention from that. But I do think that would be a dream of artists to basically put out as you create, put an album out at the end of the year, whatever you want it, but maybe the deals are structured different. You know, maybe it's not I'm delivering an album every whatever. It's I'm delivering a song, and each song equals an album, you know.
Thanks for listening to the Nashville AIMP Pubcast. For more information, check out AIMP.org or follow us at Nashville AIMP on Instagram.
The Nashville AIMP would like to give a shout out to our sponsors, Jamber and Sound Exchange. Jamber wants to know if you're looking for an easier way to capture song splits at the point of creation and organizing your catalog. Jamber is our podcast sponsor, and they are offering listeners a first look at their songwriter and publisher apps that allow songwriters to collaborate when inspiration strikes. Go to jamber.com/AIMP to sign up today. Sound Exchange develops business solutions for the entire music industry. They collect and distribute royalties on behalf of more than 155,000 recording artists, master right owners, and music publishers. Sound Exchange have paid out more than $5 billion in royalties. SX Works serves the licensing administration needs of music publishers around the world and operates CMRRA, which represents music publishers and administers mechanical rights for the majority of songs recorded, sold, and broadcast in Canada. We appreciate you listening to the Nashville Pubcast. Stay tuned for an all-new episode next week.